in many ways, it is tragic to see what's happening in this moment. I mean, look, Muslim, Arab, South Asians are more acutely vulnerable to hate violence today than they were after 9/11. Think about that. I never thought that there would ever be a time in this country where I would feel as afraid, where my community would feel as afraid. But yet here we are.
That's Arjun Singh Sethi, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Arjun Singh Sethi on the politics of hate. There's a stench in the air. Hate is out in the open. The number of hate crimes has dramatically escalated in the last couple of years. Recall Dylann Roof, who killed 9 in an African-American church in South Carolina. Or Gregory Bush, who murdered 2 black shoppers in a grocery store in Kentucky. The vitriol is spreading. The Anti-Defamation League reported a 57% increase in anti-Semitic incidents in 2017. It's the largest increase since the ADL began keeping records. In Pittsburgh, a man stormed a synagogue, killing 11, in the deadliest attack on Jews in U.S. history. The shooter, Robert Bowers, had ventilated his hatred on Gab, a social network platform for racist white nationalists and neo-Nazis. Extremist groups are using technology at a time when a growing culture of hate is taking root, both online and off. Our guest today is Arjun Singh Sethi. He's a community activist, civil rights lawyer, and a law professor based in Washington, D.C. He works closely with Muslim, Arab, and South Asian communities. His articles appear in The Guardian, Politico, USA Today, and The Washington Post. He's the editor of American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. The book was nominated by NPR as a 2018 Great Read. I talked with Arjun Singh Sethi at United World College in Montezuma, New Mexico. Welcome everyone. Welcome, Arjun, to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with some definitions. I mean, what is a hate crime?
So a hate crime is generally defined to be a crime that would not have occurred absent the victim's identity. So in other words, it is targeting somebody on account of their race, national origin, faith, and/or other protected characteristics. One important distinction that it's worthwhile to make right now is that there is lots of hateful conduct in the United States that doesn't count as a hate crime. So people saying hateful things like, go home, you don't belong here, that's hate speech, and that is protected under the First Amendment. Another example of a hateful incident that doesn't count as a hate crime is, for example, when gun-toting white supremacists line up outside mosques across the country yelling things like, Muslims, go home. You don't belong here. Go back to Saudi Arabia, etc. Which is what they sometimes say outside mosques in the United States.
And you write in your book, American Hate, that hate is part of a daily life in America and much of it goes unreported. Why does it go unreported?
So hate is a part of daily life in America for so many vulnerable communities. What I heard in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election was that hate was spiking in every facet of American life, in the workplace, classroom, and public life. And so I thought it was important to meet with survivors and capture their stories, and that's what I try to do in this book. Now, there is a challenge with respect to data. The FBI just released their annual report, and according to the FBI, there were 7,000 hate crimes committed in the year 2017. Seems like a lot, and in general, it is. But if you look at a self-reporting mechanism like the National Crime Victimization Survey, the true number of hate crimes in the United States is closer to 250,000. 250,000 hate crimes every year in the United States. Why that gap? How do we get from 7,000 to 250,000? It's because the FBI report relies on voluntary reporting by local police, meaning local police aren't required to report. So guess what? A lot of them don't report hate crimes. In some cases, they simply lie and report zero hate crimes in their jurisdiction. Better data is critical because it allows us to see who's being targeted where and by whom. Furthermore, the FBI report in particular is actually dangerous. Why? Because it actually understates the prevalence of hate in America. And by underreporting the prevalence of hate in America, it also diminishes the threat of dangerous ideologies like white supremacy, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, and the like.
Now, curiously, three major, which can unambiguously be called hate crimes, occurred in 2017 that were omitted from the FBI report. And you talk about this in your Washington Post op-ed.
Right. So just so folks have a sense of how bad the data is, some of the most egregious hate crimes committed in 2017 are not reflected in the FBI's report. So many of you know the name of Heather Heyer. Heather Heyer is the young woman who put her life and body on the line in Charlottesville to resist the white supremacist who protested there. And she was murdered in a violent hate crime. That hate crime is not included and reflected in the FBI data. It's shocking. One of the very first hate crimes that took place after Trump was inaugurated was the murder of Srinivas Kuchibhotla in Kansas City, a South Asian man who was at a bar with his friend, Alok Madhasani, when someone said something along the lines of, "You don't belong here, go back to Iran," at which point Srinivas Kuchibhotla was shot dead just outside Kansas City, Kansas. That murder isn't reflected in the FBI report. Another very egregious hate crime that happened last year took place on the Portland MAX train. So there were two young women, Destiny Mangum, Walia Muhammad. Both of them are black. One of them is Muslim. Right now they're 18 and 17. At the time they were 17 and 16. They got on a train, Portland, Oregon, when a white supremacist started terrorizing them, menacing them on a train. They moved to the back of the train, and then three upstanders intervened. I don't say bystanders, I say upstanders, because people who intervene and make a difference are called upstanders. They stand up for the two young women, at which point the white supremacist stabs two of them to death. This was in May 2017. Guess what? The FBI hate crime report doesn't include that hate crime either. Data is a huge issue, and I think the FBI report at this point is basically propaganda because it really diminishes the problems that vulnerable communities face.
Max Boot is a noted conservative commentator. He's on all the talk shows. He's part of the chatterati, as it were, the punditocracy that we have here in the golden Rolodex of experts. In an article, syndicated article that appeared in the Santa Fe New Mexican, he writes, "Trump has given the haters permission to come into the open. He is normalizing bigotry and conspiracy mongering in ways that would have been unimaginable only a few years ago." I want you to talk about that and his comment that this was unimaginable a few years ago, given the long history of racism in this country.
I'm going to make sort of a general point. Not too long ago, someone like Max Boot was writing articles that really stood for principles and values inconsistent with mine. Right. This is somebody who I believe was an apologist for the Iraq War. This is somebody who was an apologist for all kinds of dangerous policies that criminalize Muslim communities, Arab communities. And really, in this moment, it's become fashionable to be part of the resistance. And everyone wants to be part of the resistance. But I can tell you the resistance will never succeed if the very same people who defended policies that created the conditions for Donald Trump are now our chief spokespeople. So really, what Max Boot is saying in that article is not profound. It's not revolutionary. Survivors of hate have been saying it for two freaking years. On top of that, what he's saying is in one sense true. There is no question that Donald Trump has emboldened and incited hate across this country. There have literally been thousands of hate incidents in America where people have actually mentioned Donald Trump, his rhetoric, or his policies. But it is naive to think that somehow hate didn't pre-exist Donald Trump. The fact is the United States was built on a hate crime, the decimation and destruction of Native communities, and was furthered on additional hate crimes, including slavery, Jim Crow, and the like. And so when we're talking about this moment, and when we're talking about how to move forward, we need to understand that hate pre-exists to Donald Trump. Hate's going to endure after him. And in many ways, he's but a symptom of a larger history. There is a myth of American exceptionalism. The idea that somehow America doesn't have a history of racism, a history of hate, bigotry, misogyny, sexism. And guess what we do? It's ugly. It's dark. And there are many who want to rewrite it. There are many who want to ignore it. And it's because we've ignored it. It's because we've rewritten it. It's because we've diminished it that folks like Donald Trump are even able to come to power, because they capitalize on those forces that have long been a part of this country, and maybe we're just latent for a little while.
The language in using, describing indigenous peoples in this country by the early colonists, American jihadis, I call them, Taliban-like priests, were calling their faithful out to kill indigenous peoples because they were wolves. They were wild animals. They were savages. So that language of extermination gave permission for that to happen. Even in the Declaration of Independence, one of the charges that the colonists brought against King George III was that he had unleashed the merciless savages upon the colonists.
You know, language is important. Ideology is important. You look at some of the language that Donald Trump uses. He talks about how he only wants refugees from Norway. He refers to African countries and Haiti as whole countries. He talks about a caravan, right? And there are 15,000 soldiers at the border, and they don't know what they're doing. When in fact, the concern that we should really be worried about is white supremacists. You are more likely in the United States to be harmed or killed by a white supremacist than you are a Muslim or a refugee. But you would never know that by watching our media, by watching our just sort of popular television, or by hearing the politicians of today, because they are so busy demonizing vulnerable communities, whether it's the refugee community, whether it's the undocumented community. You know, one of the stories I have in my book is the story of Jeanette Vizguerra. Jeanette Vizguerra is an undocumented immigrant who was one of the first undocumented immigrants to take sanctuary at a house of worship. She took sanctuary at the First Unitarian Church in Denver, Colorado in February 2017 because she was afraid that ICE would tear her family apart. And when she took sanctuary, people threatened to blow the church up, all because they were giving this woman sanctuary from ICE and DHS. Another example, Asma Obukaye. Asma's the first Syrian refugee to ever be resettled in Boise, Idaho. And she talks about how she had 10 different interviews as a refugee to be resettled in this country. For those of you who don't know the vetting process, believe me, it's already very extreme. Right? You've got to go through burden after burden, hurdle after hurdle. And then guess what? If you're applying for refugee status, and at this, when she applied, she was in Egypt, you don't know where you're going to go. So the U.S. actually accepted her. So when Donald Trump gets on the campaign trail and calls Syrians snakes and says, we don't know who refugees are, we need to vet these people, they don't have papers, it's all lies. And Asma actually talks about how every time Trump got on the campaign trail, or even as president, said disparaging things about Syrians, refugees, and Muslims, guess what? She'd experience all kinds of microaggressions. She'd get ugly looks at the grocery store, people saying nasty things to her at the bank, because people are emulating and following the politics of the day.
And speaking of the politics of the day, I think a lot of people might be mystified as to why not thousands, not millions, but tens of millions of U.S. people are enthralled with the emanations being tweeted to us, believe that this is in fact accurate and true. How do you reach people that are in that silo of very narrow silo of information? They listen to Rush Limbaugh, they watch Sean Hannity, they read Red State and the Drudge Report and Breitbart and these other alt-right websites.
You know, it is very challenging because now if you have one of these views that isn't actually rooted in fact, you can actually find so many outlets that affirms that view, whether it's radio, whether it's television, whether it's print. And there's really no one-size-fits-all solution for how to curb that misunderstanding other than exposure, doing the hard work, spreading the stories of survivors. I believe that stories move people. I believe that images move people.
Well, what do you think about calls that are coming with greater frequency to shut down sites, to literally censor?
I mean, that's a very complicated issue, and I myself am still trying to come to terms with sort of what the right compromise is. What I do feel very comfortable saying is this. We have seen technology companies, for example, in the wake of Charlottesville, take a stand against hate. We've seen companies like Twitter, Facebook, remove hate mongers and white supremacists from their platforms. We've seen companies like Uber, Airbnb, and PayPal deny white supremacists the ability to raise funds, access services, to connect with one another. I personally am in favor of those interventions, in part because if you actually speak to survivors of hate, people who are actually impacted by hate speech, they will tell you that they never have a seat at the table. Meaning we have all these conversations about hate speech and how we should regulate it. And guess what? We never actually center those who are most impacted. And if you talk to people who have really experienced vicious cyber trolling, really experienced vicious hate speech, some of whom have PTSD, they will tell you that they favor companies taking a strong stand. And I think their voices have to be included in these conversations, but there has to be checks. So when it comes to Google, Facebook, Twitter, and the like, we have to know the reasoning. There has to be auditing mechanisms in place. There has to be an appeals process so that if your account is removed, you have the right to know why. Because we also, truthfully, have to be aware of these technology companies and the disproportionate power they also exercise in this political moment.
My own background is Armenia, and Armenians were targeted by the Turks in 1915 for what is called the first genocide of the 20th century, and my parents came as refugees to New York in 1921. Now, there's a law in France, for example, that criminalizes anyone that denies the history of the Armenian genocide. I don't feel comfortable with that. I believe in free speech, and the test of free speech has got to be that which is most despicable, not that, oh, Arjun, you're great, you're wonderful, you're brilliant. It's the other extreme, you know, that comes into question.
Yeah, and like I said, I think this is a very divisive issue, and I think that there's likely a middle ground. And so I'll give you an example. The South African Constitution, given their tragic history of apartheid, their foundational principle isn't free speech, isn't free association. It's the right to human dignity. And so as a consequence, if there are things that people do, if there are things that people say that violate that principle, it's not tolerated. And so again, I think there's probably a give and take here about what's appropriate. But what I do feel very comfortable saying is that survivors, people who have been directly impacted. In this sense, you're right. You are somebody who has been directly impacted. My experience has been overwhelming majority of them favor the U.S. government and favor technology companies taking a stronger stand against hate. And let me also give you another very concrete example, and this is another thing I feel very comfortable saying. It's also easy to forget how free speech also functions in the context of the right to bear arms. So I will tell you, I personally am uncomfortable and think it is absurd for a young Muslim to have to walk by gun-toting white supremacists en route to Friday prayer saying, you don't belong here, go home, ISIS. That to me is absurd, right? And any legal apparatus that ultimately created that, that allows for gun-toting white supremacists to be yelling hateful things to young Muslim children on the way to Friday prayer, is not a legal system in my mind that is functioning right. And it might be that we need to talk more about the right to bear arms and what that looks like. It might be we need to talk more about what is protected under free speech versus as opposed to not. But I think there are examples of things that are allowed under our current system that are really unconscionable, and that's one example.
Stephen Biko was a prominent activist with the African National Congress. He was killed during held in custody by the South African police. He said that the greatest weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. How do you break free from that kind of feeling like a victim, feeling oppressed?
As I've traveled the country and as I've gone to places like Tulsa, Oklahoma, Whitefish, Montana, Victoria, Texas, I have found that survivors who have lost so much, survivors whose houses of worship have been burned to the ground, survivors who've been assaulted, survivors who've lost loved ones to hate violence, are resisting. They are pushing back. We need to follow their example. We think we need to learn from them. But on top of that, I just think we also just need to remember the importance of community, remember our own strength, and remember how we have braved through so much. Right? You look at the Native community today, and you remember they've survived genocide. You look at the Black community in this country, and you remember they've survived genocide. Look at the Armenian community, and you remember they've survived genocide. And a genocide that today, still so many people don't know about. Still so many people are trying to rewrite out of history. So I think it's learning from history. I think it's building community. And honestly, looking to survivors and learning from their resilience and learning from their conviction and trying to follow their example.
Well, history is not just a collection of facts. There's much more in it that is denied, it's distorted and manipulated. Howard Zinn, the great historian who wrote A People's History of the United States, talked about the importance of knowing the past so that there isn't this, as Gore Vidal calls the USA, the United States of amnesia, this amnesiac quality that exists in this country where last week is history, last month is ancient history, and last year is like prehistoric.
You're absolutely right. And as a community activist, I get trolled and bullied online and attacked for all kinds of reasons. But I will tell you, the line in the book that most irritates people, that in some cases infuriates people, is the line where I say the United States was built on a hate crime. Because there is this myth of American exceptionalism. And in some cases, it's amnesia. In some cases, it's worse. It's literally an intentional effort to rewrite that history, to exclude it entirely from textbooks.
Noam Chomsky has said about amnesia, historical amnesia is dangerous, not only because it undermines moral and intellectual integrity, but also lays the groundwork for crimes that lie ahead.
I mean, Noam Chomsky hits it and he brings it. And this is another example of how he does it. You know, if we don't learn from the past, we are doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past. And in many ways, it is tragic to see what's happening in this moment. I mean, look, Muslim, Arabs, South Asians, and Sikh Americans are more acutely vulnerable to hate violence today than they were after 9/11. Think about that. Right now, I know of a few years on you guys, but I got to tell you, when I was growing up at that time, I never thought that there would ever be a time in this country where I would feel as afraid, where my community would feel as afraid. But yet here we are. because we didn't learn from it. And so I do think that part of what we need to be doing in this moment is actually having this reconciliation with our past. And as part of these town halls and community conversations, like tonight, really, that we're holding across the country in this moment, we need to be talking about Donald Trump. We need to be talking about the sins of today, but we need to also be talking about how they are in so many ways rooted in the past. And that's how someone like him can come to power. And that's how someone like him, who really is a budding fascist, some people would say he's just a complete outright fascist. At the minimum, he's a budding fascist, can come to power with the conviction that he did.
What was your response to his comment, the assertion he made that I am a nationalist?
I, in my book, I'll actually read from it because it's pretty explicit, because again, I don't mince my words. There are many who ask why President Trump does not condemn acts of hate and bigotry, and when he does, why it takes him so long. But Donald Trump told us who he was a long time ago, and it is time we believed him. He is a racist and a sexist, and his ideologies are white supremacy and greed. He is the hater-in-chief, and his rhetoric, history, and policies show it. So that's my response. I also think, as we've been saying, that there have been a lot of very ugly, virulent forces that have been around in this country for a long time. You can call them nativism. You can call it xenophobia. You can call it white supremacy. And what Donald Trump did really was what demagogues do. He played to the politics of fear. And, you know, some people, you know, they talk about fascists and they say one of the primary ways to identify a fascist is that they appeal to the dominant cultural majority as victims, right? And that's what Donald Trump did. He appealed to the dominant cultural majority. 70% of this country is white American, and made them feel like victims and reaffirmed that bias that many have, that they are somehow losing their rights, that they are somehow losing their privileges. And guess what? A white person losing privilege is just a more level playing field.
Fred Garner and Michael Brown and Tamar Rice and Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. I mean, it can go on and on. The number of people that have been shot, all people of color, by state security forces, the police. Would you classify those as hate crimes?
So that's a really good question. And, you know, I would leave that to that community. I would leave that to those survivors. What I will tell you is this, is that I met lots of people who actually consider certain forms of state violence as hate crimes, as state-sponsored forms of hate. So I gave you the example of Jeanette Vizguerra. Jeanette Vizguerra, undocumented mother, forced to take sanctuary at a house of worship. In her mind, the potential for an ICE raid, or ICE raids generally, is a state-sponsored form of hate, because it's going to tear her apart from her family. Dominic Evans is both trans and disabled. Dominic actually talks in the book how without the Affordable Care Act, he will die. And now he and so many other people have said this to their politicians, to others. And yet the Republican Party continues to make repeal of the Affordable Care Act one of their core campaign principles. So for him, repeal of health care is a state-sponsored form of hate. And again, coming full circle, is the testimonial of Ruth Hopkins. Ruth Hopkins is a Native lawyer, scientist, judge, who was actually born on the Standing Rock Reservation and then experienced police violence there. And in Ruth's mind, the police violence that she experienced at Standing Rock was also a state-sponsored form of hate, because it is a continuation of the hate that her community has experienced ever since they encountered white folks hundreds of years ago. It wasn't enough to commit genocide. It wasn't enough to shove them onto reservations. It wasn't enough to continue to steal their land for oil pipelines, right? Now they're assaulting water protectors. They don't call themselves protesters. They call themselves water protectors. So there are many in that community who look at sort of police violence as a hate crime. Truthfully, regardless of how you define it, you can't separate state violence from interpersonal violence. So state violence is an act of violence committed by someone in uniform, by a government authority. Interpersonal violence is kind of like an act of hate violence that's committed by another citizen or another person in this country. You can't separate them because they're related. So when Donald Trump says he's going to ban Muslims and refugees, cage and separate immigrant families, roll back protections for gender violence survivors, roll back protections for transgender students, roll back consent decrees, which is the primary mechanism that we have used for decades to keep police officers accountable. I'm not saying it's work, because police officers still have lots of leeway, too much leeway. But when all of those things happen at the government and the highest level, it's going to put a target on our back. Of course we're going to be targeted. Of course there's going to be an uptick in hate violence when the president is preaching politics of division and implementing policies that execute that vision.
You're listening to Arjun Singh Sethi on the politics of hate. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program and his book, American Hate, Survivors Speak Out, by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. In a victory for environmentalists and Mother Earth, a judge has ruled against the Keystone XL pipeline. Do you think it's a stretch to be talking about the assault on Mother Nature, on the Earth, the plunder and looting of natural resources as a kind of hate crime?
You know, David mentioned that recently, and it was really beautiful, and I've been thinking about it, and I think it's really fair, because I will tell you, we are all passengers on this planet, and when you think about the destruction that we have done to it, when you think about how much of the planet we have annihilated by virtue of our existence, it's unconscionable. And I do think it's worthwhile to be thinking about the assault of Mother Nature as a form of hate, as a form of unbelievable, unconscionable violence. And I encourage all of you to get involved in that struggle, because I feel like in many ways, that's a struggle that connects us all. But even then, when we're talking about liberation and when we're talking about justice, we have to be international in our focus. So, for example, it shouldn't come as a surprise that Guantanamo Bay is and always has been a prison for Muslim men, that extrajudicial drone strikes disproportionately impact Muslim-majority countries, and climate change has hit the global south the hardest, with 6 of the 10 countries most impacted being in Africa.
Truth tellers really go out on a limb. Martin Luther King Jr., in his great Riverside Church speech, Beyond Vietnam, warned the country about the giant triplets of racism, extreme militarism — he didn't call it capitalism, he called it extreme militarism — and imperialism. He also said the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, a year later to the day he was murdered in Memphis, Tennessee. Talk about the dangers of speaking out.
That was such an important moment in American history, right? Because so many people, so many contemporaries of Dr. King said, don't get involved with Vietnam. What are you doing? It's already such a divisive issue. And he said in that speech, right, we've got to be inclusive. We have to be internationalist, and we have to be on the lookout against these things like materialism, exploitation, injustice, and the like. And so he took that bold step. He was inclusive. He was internationalist as a theory of liberation. And again, it's a model that we should all follow. But there is no question there are perils to speaking out. There are activists every day in this country who are subject to heightened forms of surveillance. Undocumented immigrants who are activists are so much more likely to be arrested and placed in deportation proceedings. That's a practice that we've seen recently. In some cases, they're more likely to be subject to police violence. They're more likely to be subject to things like NSA intelligence collection. And specifically, survivors of hate — people don't realize this, but in this day and age in particular, when survivors of hate come forward and tell their story, sometimes they're targeted again. They're cyber-trolled. They're accused of fabrication. Look at Destiny Mangum and Walia Muhammad, the two young black girls who were on the MAX train in Portland, Oregon, story I told you about. In their testimonial, they talk about how they got death threats on their social media accounts for weeks, right? I saw them recently, and they were still saying they intermittently get threats, all because they were victims on a train, and they decided to tell their story.
You're a member of the Sikh community. Usually it's mispronounced as Sikh, but the correct pronunciation is Sikh. It's a 15th century Indian religion, but I want you to talk about the Sikh community in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, and what happened to them.
You know, in August of 2011, there was a terrible hate crime that targeted the Sikh community in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. A white supremacist, an openly white, open sort of white supremacist, stormed the Oak Creek Gurdwara and murdered six Sikh worshipers, injured several others. And it was a very difficult time for the Sikh community, but they braved through it with extraordinary courage and conviction. I mean, I say that for a couple reasons. Number one, we still don't actually know why the shooter in that case chose the Gurdwara. Did he target the Sikhs because he perceived them as others, right? Because Sikhs are often targeted because we're perceived as others, right? We have turbans, we have beards, sometimes we have brown skin. We don't like the way we look. Did he target us because he thought we were Muslim? Maybe. That happens sometimes too. But the Sikh community didn't come out that day and say, right, we're not Muslim. Leave us alone, right? They talked about solidarity. And they talked about the importance of standing with all vulnerable communities. The other thing they did, and I think this is absolutely extraordinary, is the day after this attack, when the Sikh community gathered and recited their holy prayer, the Ardas, they asked God, Sikhs believe in one God, to pray for the six people who lost their lives, but also asked the community and God to remember and pray for the soul of the shooter. That type of reconciliation, that capacity for forgiveness, that possibility of restorative justice is one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen. And I want you to juxtapose it for a second to what we saw, for example, after the Boston Marathon bombing. I don't know how many of you remember, but immediately after that, there were folks who wouldn't even let the elder Saharnev brother be buried. Because there was so much vengeance, there was so much vitriol, there was so much retribution that was in everyone's hearts, minds, and souls, that eventually he had to be buried anonymously, very quietly, in a cemetery in Virginia, and it was basically not announced. And that particular owner of that cemetery thought he was going to have to close down because he had actually buried him in the ground. So just know that there are different possibilities for how we emerge from hate, how we emerge from violence. And what the Sikh community did that day is an extraordinary example. And in my book, I give examples like that. So, for example, I gave you the story of Asma al-Bukhaya, the Syrian refugee. Asma also talks in the story about how one day her young son was walking in downtown Boise. And someone asked, "Are you Muslim?" And when he said yes, he was violently punched to the ground. Asma was later invited to court by the judge in the sentencing hearing. It often happens, right? Sort of the end of the case, once the person is convicted or found guilty or pleads guilty, the judge wants to know what the victim and the victim's family thinks. So when the judge asks Asma, "What should happen to the man who attacked your son?" Asma says, "Your Honor, he shouldn't go to jail. Because he's not going to learn about Syrians, Muslims, and refugees in jail. He needs to spend time with our communities. He needs to get to know us. He needs to know why we came to this country." And really, it's extraordinary, right? Because the United States is the prison capital of the world. We're home to 4% of the world's total population, but house 25% of the world's total prison population. Asma had every reason in that moment to say, "I'm vulnerable. I'm a Syrian refugee. My kid was just assaulted. Lock him up, throw away the key." But she didn't do that. She's practicing restorative justice in the most carceral state in modern history. The New Jim Crow, check it out. Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. It's a really amazing book. And principal argument is that mass incarceration is the new Jim Crow. Namely, it was a calculated, intentional effort to incapacitate the black community across this country. And she walks you through how laws were drafted, how laws were executed, how laws have been interpreted, how police enforce laws, how they face discrimination at every step of the process, whether it's arrest, whether it's indictment, whether it's conviction, and how even when they've served their time, they have the shadow of a conviction following them, a shadow they can never give up. Many of them can't vote. Many of them can't get jobs. Many of them aren't entitled to government benefits on account of a crime. And I got to tell you something. I'll just break it down for you. You know, when white hipsters started smoking marijuana during yoga, all of a sudden it was cool. I mean, really. I mean, that kind of changed the boat, right? Because black folks were doing it for a long time, and we threw them in jail. There are still black folks in jail whose only crime was having marijuana. And yet there are people outside those same prisons who are smoking J's.
In the fall of 2017, I visited Madison, Wisconsin. A friend picked me up at the airport and he said, I want to show you something. I want to take you to the memorial that had been built there to honor the memory of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. People here should know about the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. Some very courageous young Americans went to Spain to fight the first battles of World War II. This is 1936. There was a fascist uprising led by Francisco Franco, who was supported by Hitler and Mussolini. The great democracies was kind of on the sides and not really getting involved too much. And these courageous Americans went there to defend freedom and democracy. Anyway, to make a long story short, the monument had just been defaced with swastikas. Many of the members of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade happened to be of the Jewish faith. And so this was clearly an attack on Judaism and on Jews. Just a little anecdote that, you know, I experienced. And then, you know, you have these marked spike in attacks on Jewish community centers, synagogues. The Anti-Defamation League said there's been a marked spike in hate crimes against Jews. Is that part of this whole fabric that you're talking about?
And there's no question that anti-Semitism is on the rise. And I think it is often part of the same problem. So, for example, it shouldn't be a surprise that the shooter at the Tree of Life Synagogue had both Islamophobic views and anti-Semitic views, because so much of the bigotry of today comes from the same and one and only well of white supremacy.
And white supremacy is also on the uptick, again, given permission by someone sitting in the Oval Office who could not bring himself to condemn the white supremacists at Charlottesville who were chanting, Jews will not replace us. This is someone who has an Orthodox daughter and an Orthodox son-in-law. Rather remarkable.
And the truth is the number of white supremacist groups has been steadily on the rise ever since Obama took office.
Trump.
Obama, believe it or not. Yes, because there were so many white supremacists and white nationalists who were upset that a black man was president. So we actually saw some of that architecture coming into place even before Trump took office. But again, there is no question that it is now spiking immensely, both in a formalized way, but also in an informalized way. So for example, if you recall, the anniversary protest that was supposed to happen in D.C. 1 year after Charlottesville ended up being very sparsely attended, because some of the grand masters of the movement said, don't go. Because if they catch you on television, they'll ruin your life. So now a lot of the white supremacy, a lot of that movement, some of it's out in the open, but some of it isn't. But it's there. There were incidents just weeks ago where white supremacist flyers were found across universities across the country, dozens of universities had incidents. So there's no question that white supremacy is on the rise, both in a formal way and an informal.
And Asians have historically been targeted by white supremacists, beginning with maybe the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, the incarceration of 100,000 Japanese Americans, many of them citizens of the U.S., in 1942 by the liberal icon Franklin D. Roosevelt and his Supreme Court that, you know, signed off on that.
You know, I was flying back from Los Angeles, and I was sitting next to a historian. And you know what he told me? He said, "Arjun, the United States treated German prisoners of war who they brought back to the United States better than they did Japanese Americans. They treated German prisoners of war better than they did their own citizens who they put in incarceration camps." The Japanese American community has moved away from the term internment. They generally say incarceration now. But it's absolutely true. You look at the Chinese Exclusion Act. You look at Bhagat Singh Tind and his story, a Sikh American who tried to become a citizen in the early part of the 20th century. And the only way he was able to obtain citizenship was to actually say he was white, because that's the only way he could get it.
I did an interview with a Hunter College professor. His name is Benjamin Hett, H-E-T-T. He's written a book called The Death of Democracy. It's very interesting. It's about the Weimar Republic, which at that time was sort of the pinnacle of European civilization, music, the arts. Germany was leading the world in science and scholarship, all kinds of indexes. Germany was the country. And how was it possible that within a short period of time, a relatively unknown figure rose to become chancellor and then dictator of Germany, Adolf Hitler? People didn't take him seriously. Well, he's just, you know, he's a phenomenon. In fact, I just heard someone on corporate news use that term to describe the sitting president. It's just a phenomenon. Not taking this, appreciating the danger posed by someone who was preaching hate. It was all out there. You couldn't miss it unless you were, you know, unless you intentionally wanted to. It was all programmed in Mein Kampf. It was published in 1925. It wasn't a secret, but people didn't take it seriously.
Toni Morrison says this, when people tell you who they are, you should believe them the first time. And Donald Trump told us who he was a really long time ago. And I don't know why we equivocate. And I don't even know why the Democratic Party equivocates. I don't know why they don't call him things like racist, bigot, and sexist, because that's what he is. And in many ways, you know, theories of fascism or theorists of fascism have actually said the real test is whether he gets reelected. Because if he gets reelected, we're basically a sort of a full-fledged fascist state. You know, one point that I'll make specifically about this time before Hitler came to power, just so you understand some of the intersections between xenophobia and racism, German thinkers during the 30s were fascinated by the United States laws of separate but equal. They were fascinated that the U.S. government had created its legal system for actually subjugating an entire community, namely black folks. So just think about that, right? Before Hitler, Germans were looking to America for how to create an architecture for oppression and disenfranchisement. It's unbelievable.
That's well documented. The Nazis were inspired by the attacks and extermination campaigns conducted against the indigenous population, Native Americans, and then the reservations. That also attracted their attention. They were also very admiring of the Turkish genocide of the Armenians. So again, you know, there are all these historical parallels that we ignore at our peril. Some of you may know this. It's from Margaret Mead, a distinguished U.S. Anthropologist in the 1930s and 1940s. She writes, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed individuals can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." Think about Elizabeth Cady Stanton in upstate New York in 1848, meeting with a handful of women, literally a handful. And that was the beginning of the women's movement. No one gave them any, you know, no one cheered them on. They were met with derision. "Well, you're wasting your time. It's a man's world."
Politicians won't save us. Policies won't save us. Only community will, which is why I encourage everyone to get to know your neighbor, get to know your neighborhood, get to know your community. Build community, because that is the first line of defense. If every community changes, the country changes. And I do think that we've done a great disservice in our country by overemphasizing top-bottom politics as opposed to bottom-up politics. And I completely agree that there are umpteen examples, both in this country and historically, of leaders, local leaders, people you don't know about, people who sometimes paid the ultimate sacrifice, who've made a world of difference. So really, it's just really incumbent on all of us to use our voices to effectuate change.
Talk about the dignity of resistance. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. used to say that, you know, it's better to be on your feet fighting back than on your knees, you know, begging.
The way I think about it in a very personal way, and I always tell my students this, and I say never, ever surrender the moral high ground. Because there is a genius to it, there is a beauty to it, and I'll tell you one of the reasons that I can do this work. I was just on a stage yesterday. I'm going to be on a stage in a few more days, and I can do this every time with conviction, with passion, and with care, is because I believe in what I'm doing. And when I put my head on my pillow every night, I know that I'm standing for justice. And when I wake up in the morning and I'm a little tired or I'm a little tired being on a plane, I know that I'm on the right side. So I do think that the moral high ground is critical, and I don't think that we should ever surrender it. And here's the thing. It's a test, because there will be so many times in your life where you will be asked to surrender that moral high ground. And really, your life comes down to what you do at those moments. Do you compromise, or do you stand by the principles, you know, that schools like UWC try to inculcate?
What do you think of the hashtag MeToo movement and Black Lives Matter?
I think they're both very important movements. I do think that we need to recognize that MeToo wasn't started by white women celebrities in 2016. It was started by a Black woman more than 10 years ago. And, you know, we need to ensure that women who are most vulnerable to gender violence have the opportunity to tell their stories. And that is generally women of color who work in low-wage professions. And so while I think Me Too is important, and while I think it's drawn a very important spotlight onto misogyny, sexism, and rape culture, I do think that it's got to be inclusive. And women of color have been saying this. I do think we need to be centering women of color in that conversation. You know, and I think what happened to Dr., you know, Christine Blasey Ford is really an American tragedy, and it's going to go down as another very sad moment in the history of this country. I think Black Lives Matter is an important movement. I think Black Lives Matter has drawn important visibility to the fact that Black folks experience racism in every facet of American life. And one of the founding sort of principles of Black Lives Matter, which I think is extraordinarily beautiful, is when Black people are free, we will all be free. Because Black folks experience so much of that structural institutional racism, that when we unravel those institutions is the moment that we've actually been able to tackle that ugly history that we've been talking about this evening.
I think when I was watching the president speak in Montana, when he was mocking Dr. Ford, par for the course, no big breaking news there. He's done that with disabled people, physically challenged people, etc., women in particular. But what disturbed me the most was the response of the audience behind him, the laughing, the chortling, the guys going like this with their elbows, you know, like, wow, he's really bringing it on. That bothered me much more than the venom, you know, emanating from the president's mouth.
And I think a lot of people had that reaction. And it just goes to show how much work we have to do. Misogyny, sexism, rape culture can't be distinguished.
Patriarchy.
They're forms of hate. They can't be separated from hate violence. My book centers, in fact, women of color. Because women of color are disproportionately vulnerable to those things. Hate violence, sexism, misogyny, sexual assault, but they are also simultaneously on the front lines pushing back and protecting communities and leading that resistance. You know, what does hate try to do? Hate tries to do away with difference. It tries to subjugate uniqueness. And the survivors I met refused to be silenced. And speaking out is absolutely the most basic and vital form of resistance, and it is the well from which all other resistance springs.
Thanks very much, Arjun Singh Sethi.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Arjun Singh Sethi on the politics of hate. I talked with him at United World College in Montezuma, New Mexico. Arjun Singh Sethi is a community activist, civil rights lawyer, and law professor based in Washington, D.C. He's the editor of American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. The book was nominated by NPR as a 2018 Great Read. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Michelle Alexander, Chris Hedges, Stephen Bezruchka, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Kianga Yamata-Taylor. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Arjun Singh Sethi on the Politics of Hate, and his book, American Hate, Survivors Speak Out, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Pat Leon of the Las Vegas, New Mexico Peace and Justice Center and Naomi Swinton of United World College. Robin Collier of KCEI in Taos recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.